are we going to do that to the Earth Mother? How are we going to take the fever away from her? And it's not going to get better until somebody starts to take care of her.
Indigenous leaders talk about climate change in Anchorage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 20th of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, lawmakers finished the session, but not all the work they set out to accomplish.
There was just this agreement that things that might be a little bit stressful just wouldn't be dealt with.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Representatives from Indigenous peoples all over the world are meeting this week in Anchorage to prepare for this winter's climate treaty talks in Copenhagen. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
There are hundreds of them in the Dena'ina Convention Center. From island nations and coastal areas being flooded by rising ocean levels, jungle peoples watching their rain disappear, forest peoples watching their trees die of thirst and drought, lowland people worried because the glaciers in the mountains that feed their streams are rapidly shrinking, many others, including northern peoples, watching their ice disappear. An array of foundations, agencies, and two northern governments have put together the million-plus dollars to make this Indigenous Peoples Global Summit on Climate Change happen. The hope is that just as the Kyoto Treaty has become a household word, so will the Anchorage Declaration that will be written by the people who are often on the front lines of climate change. As the summit meeting opened, Patricia Cochran of the Inuit Circumpolar Council asked for a unified statement by the end of the meeting on the 24th.
A long and hard process for all of us over the next 5 days to develop a declaration that we can all agree upon, something that we can put forward to the rest of the world. But this is our goal. We really need to come together united as Indigenous people worldwide.
Translation booths line the back of the room, and people wear earpieces to listen in French, Russian, Spanish, or English. Through the first day of the summit, regions of the world reported: Arctic, Pacific, Latin America, Africa, Asia, and so forth. The second day, the sessions will be broken down by subject area. Those will be closed to the press. In the course of the summit, speeches are scheduled by the President of the UN General Assembly, the World Bank, the President of Bolivia, and others. The Anchorage Declaration itself is due out in draft form Friday morning. The final version will be taken to the next climate treaty talks in Copenhagen. The first day speeches to the entire assembly came from the young, who pointed out that it was their generation that will have to deal with the rising consequences of climate warming, and the elders. Carrie Dan of the Western Shoshone said, "It's as if Mother Earth has a fever, and it's up to those closest to her to articulate what's needed to heal her."
How are we going to do that to the Earth Mother? How are we going to take the fever away from her? There's millions of people, humans, that walk on this earth. So today she's having this fever, and it's not going to get better until somebody starts to take care of her.
As the summit got underway, there were nearly as many volunteers and observers from media and interest groups as delegates. There's a reception this evening at the Alaska Native Heritage Center, and tomorrow a keynote speech from Alaska Federation of Natives President Julie Kitka. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
The capital city finally has a new senator. Lieutenant Governor Sean Parnell administered the oath of office to Dennis Egan last night after the Senate had adjourned the regular session for the year. Juneau was without representation in the state Senate for 49 days. Kim Elton resigned his seat March 2nd to take a job with the Obama administration. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander has this update.
Rumors were rampant in the state capitol yesterday that Governor Palin would appoint Dennis Egan, considered a peace candidate. Mayor Bruce Botello last week suggested Egan as a compromise after Palin made it clear she would not appoint any of the nominees proposed by local party members. Senate Democrats had rejected all her appointments, but Palin continued to back her first choice, Tim Grusendorf, until sometime yesterday. Senator Johnny Ellis said the logjam finally broke when Egan's name was formally submitted to the governor.
The Juneau Democrats expanded their list to include Dennis Egan. They informed the governor of that decision this afternoon. The governor appointed Dennis Egan. The Senate Democrats considered his appointment, and there was unanimous support for Dennis Egan. So it's all worked out amazingly well.
About 6:30 p.m., the governor's office hastily called a news conference outside the Capitol building.
I'm very pleased to announce that Mayor Dennis Egan will be Juneau's next senator, and very pleased with our Senate Democrats and administration working together on this. You saw some sausage-making process, if you will, to get us to this point, but I'm very happy with this election and with their acceptance of Dennis Egan.
Juneau Democratic Party members recommended in early March that Palin appoint Representative Beth Curtula, but it was clear then the governor would not appoint Curtula. Palin started her own solicitation process and continued to ignore other local nominees made by Juneau Democrats. Yesterday, she blamed the delay in seating a senator on the public process.
It took a while, but I'm just thankful that we are where we are today with a very good senator that will do a great job representing the diversity of the Juneau population.
As Egan was being escorted into Senate chambers, Governor Palin came into the Senate gallery to watch. A few minutes later, he took and signed the oath of office in the governor's conference room. Egan thanked the governor and Senate Democrats for finally agreeing on a senator for Juneau.
30,000 people in this community were without representation for most of the legislative session. I was concerned about that, and I do personally want to thank Mayor Botello for proposing my name as a compromise candidate.
Representatives Beth Curtula and Kathy Munoz say it's a relief to have a senator again in Juneau's delegation. Egan is the son of Alaska's first governor, a former mayor of Juneau, and a longtime Alaska broadcaster. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
The legislature adjourned 4 hours short of its 90-day session limit last night, getting the essentials done and setting up a lot of work for next year. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The House and Senate plowed through very full calendars all weekend in order to adjourn last night, but they made it with 4 hours to spare.
Notify the House that we have adjourned.
Leading up to the final moments, they dealt with a new minimum wage bill, statutory permanent changes to the Power Cost Equalization Program, expanding the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, and spending $7 million for beginning work on an in-state gas line, and a $1.8 billion capital budget. But the final step on a bill spending some $450 million in federal economic stimulus money put a cap on what had begun as the most controversial issue of the session. House Finance Co-Chair Mike Hawker made the final pitch, saying the Senate had helped in their search for the strings they'd been warned about.
I sincerely appreciate the assistance of everyone in this room and the perseverance as we sorted that out, and I think certainly from my standpoint have come to believe that accepting this money is in the best interest of the state of Alaska.
As it did the first time the House voted on it, the bill passed unanimously. House Speaker Mike Chenault said he didn't speak for the governor, but for lawmakers, learning the facts made the decisions easier.
The legislatures became more comfortable with accepting that money. And certainly we hope through our conversations with the governor that that she also feels more comfortable and is more willing to accept those federal funds than what she was originally.
Governor Palin said she does feel more comfortable with the information and consideration the legislature put into the bill. And she says she'll continue to look at the stimulus money and will act based on how the money will be used.
It's my job and its administrators' jobs to prudently administer the funds that will be received by the state. We're going to keep working with lawmakers in the interim, with public, taking more public input on the ramifications of the economic stimulus package, and we will kind of on a case-by-case basis decide what to do with each one of those dollars.
Not everyone was satisfied with the session. House Democrats argued during debate against the Republicans' decision to fund education with money from the state's constitutionally protected savings account, charging the majority with setting up a slush fund for future use. And the Senate minority charged the public was shortchanged. They're leaving issues unaddressed.
Part of that is maybe because of the budget, but in addition, there was just this agreement that things that might be a little bit stressful just wouldn't be dealt with. And we think that's a shame, because if there's a place in the state of Alaska for tough policy to be discussed, it's in this building.
Neither the governor nor legislators expect any special session the rest of the year. They meet again for 90 days next January. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
A bill loosening wastewater discharge requirements for cruise ships has passed the legislature. It needs the governor's signature to become law. The administration has so far backed the bill. Sitka Senator Bert Stedman said the measure was a compromise acceptable to the cruise industry as well as backers of strict water quality standards.
This bill addresses how DEC will permit water discharge from vessels, providing time for vessels to develop and install the necessary technology. DEC would have the authority to issue three-year wastewater discharge permits that incorporate the best available technology for effluent treatment. Cruise ship companies are given until December 31st, 2015 to develop technology that meets water quality standards at the discharge point.
Cruise lines earlier sought mixing zones, which dilute pollutants rather than regulation at the point of discharge. The bill gives the industry more time to meet standards that were supposed to go into effect for the 2010 season. It also establishes a scientific panel to advise the Department of Environmental Conservation, which regulates ship discharges. The bill underwent significant changes since its introduction. The final version puts a time limit on waivers to the new standards. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Juneau School District considers giving high schoolers some extra sleep.
I'm a senior, really tired, so can't exactly think as well. It's later on in the day, so it'd be better if it started later.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
Today marks 10 years since the Columbine High School massacre, the 1999 slayings of a teacher and 12 fellow students by two classmates in Colorado shocked the world and ushered in a new era of vigilance in schools. Fairbanks Assistant Superintendent for Secondary Schools Wayne Gerke says Columbine was a wake-up call.
After Columbine happened, we had more efforts focused on safety, of course, as it did every school district across the country. We actually brought up safety experts that next summer, and they did tours of our schools, worked with us on beefing up our crisis plans.
Gerke says schools have developed a range of overlapping programs and measures aimed at recognizing and dealing with any potential problems before they escalate. That includes prevention and intervention specialists, elementary-level behavior aides, school counselors, safety monitors, and even police officers in some schools. Gerke says a key aspect of diffusing any trouble is open lines of communication and basic awareness of what's going on with students.
Schools are constantly vigilant about safety in their buildings, and administrators always keeping their eyes and ears open. And whenever there's any type of rumor or situation at all, they follow up on it. And a lot of times, whenever they don't know exactly where those rumors have started, they might put the school in lockdown just to make sure everybody is safe and they can follow up on things.
Gerke says there are on average, a couple of lockdowns a month at Fairbanks area schools. Few are violence-related, but students are disciplined in rare cases. The most high-profile local incident was a Columbine copycat plot at North Pole Middle School. The planned massacre was discovered and police arrested six students on April 22, 2006. Gerke says schools have to err on the side of caution.
I don't think that we're developing an expectation that kids are going to be bad by having these rules in place. We are just, a lot of times, reacting to what's happening in the community. And if we need to put something in place for the safety of students, we will do it.
Gerke says the challenge is to balance awareness and vigilance with the real mission of schools, educating kids. Police say a man with a gun arrested outside Lathrop High School last week did not have any violent intentions. Anthony Gay was spotted with it in a vehicle on campus last Thursday. Fairbanks Police Sergeant Jeremy Lindhag says the 21-year-old, who is not a student at the school, told officers he did not come to Lathrop to cause trouble.
He was there dropping someone off, and due to some prior contacts with people, he stated he was carrying this weapon for protection. No threats were made towards anyone at the school or any harm to anyone else. It was just basically for his personal protection.
Lindhag says it's illegal to carry a gun on school grounds, and Gay was charged with misconduct involving a weapon. He says a teacher and school safety liaison spotted Gay with the gun. As early as this fall, Juneau's high schoolers could grab a few extra Z's in the morning. A proposal is underway to change school start times in the Juneau School District. The administration recommends high school begin at 9:15, 75 minutes later than the current start time, but not everyone in the community is in sync with the change. KTOO's Rebecca Shear has more.
When Benjamin Franklin said, "Early to bed and early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise," he wasn't referring to your average teenager.
It works great for a six-year-old, but for a 14-year-old boy, that's probably the worst thing that you can do.
Robert Latta is a sleep physician in Anchorage. He says research over the last 25 years shows little kids have no problem bouncing out of bed in the wee small hours. But when they reach their teens, hormonal changes make them more apt to wake up and stay up later. In fact, a high school student's peak performance occurs after 10 in the morning and between 8 and 10 at night.
So when you tell a student to go to sleep at 9 o'clock because they have to get up early, they will lay there hour after hour after hour. Finally, they fall asleep at 2 in the morning, and then they have to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to go to school. And now they only get 5 or 6 hours of sleep.
Latta says that would be like asking an adult who has an entirely different sleep-wake cycle to hit the hay at 5 p.m. and rise and shine at 3 a.m.
If we were required to be on that schedule, it'd be very difficult to do so.
It just feels unnatural.
Exactly. It's unnatural to fall asleep at 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
Which is why more than 80 school districts across the U.S. have changed their high school start times, according to the National Sleep Foundation. And Juneau might be next.
So about 2 months ago or 6 weeks ago, our principal group came to a consensus about a later start time for our older teens who right now get dropped off at school. Bernie, Patty, what time did
you... 7:20.
Which means some of them, of course, who live out the road, get up and are on a bus by about, 6:15, 6:30.
Assistant Superintendent Lori Scanling and the district's principals, including Juneau Douglas High School's Bernie Sorensen and Thunder Mountain's Patty Bippis, recently held a public forum to discuss a later start time for high school, sure, but also
a earlier start time for our youngsters who are up and ready to go by about a lot earlier than 9 o'clock, which is when some of our elementary schools now start.
Roughly 80 people attended the forum, mostly parents, many of whom voiced support for the proposal.
I think this is way overdue. Our family completely supports this.
But others expressed concerns about everything from kids' safety as they walk to school.
Winter months, dark, kids walking in the streets, no sidewalks, during rush hour.
To the prospect of overstuffing already jam-packed buses.
The number of students that ride in the Montana Creek area, the bus is so crowded, some of them are 3 in a seat.
Some also worried about after-school jobs and activities. If high school doesn't let out until 3:45, what about students whose jobs end at 5? And though Scanling says activities like football, cross-country, track, soccer, and volleyball can adapt to the schedule changes, boys' basketball practice wouldn't end until 11 p.m.
I find it hard to believe that you guys think 11 o'clock is an okay time for kids to get home from a practice.
I don't think
activity.
We do. So I don't want you to say that we think that.
So what are you saying then?
We see it as a factor that needs to be mitigated.
Scanling admits a number of factors need to be mitigated before the administration presents its proposal to the school board next month, like the 20 minutes of commute time the new bus routes will add for Harborview and Auk Bay Elementary students, and the increased costs families could face if earlier release times require additional after-school childcare.
So that definitely will be a challenge. As a district, we don't think it's a challenge enough to not do this.
Because what it all boils down to, Scanling says, is what's best for the students, especially high schoolers.
What do you think?
Well, I think school should just stay the same time because we got stuff to do after school.
I'm a senior, really tired, so can't exactly think as well. It's later on in the day, so it'd be better if it started later.
I think high school should start earlier.
Like, how early is early?
Maybe an hour earlier.
How do you feel about that?
I disagree.
And science disagrees as well, says sleep expert Robert Latta.
I think they estimated between 10 and 20% of kids are falling asleep in school. So you're getting the kids to school earlier, but are they really learning?
Latta cites studies out of Minnesota and Massachusetts that demonstrate positive ties between later high school start times, better academic performance, and improved overall health. So to amend Ben Franklin just a bit, later to bed and later to rise could very well make a teen healthy and wise. As for the wealthy part, well, we're still awaiting the research on that. In Juneau, I'm Rebecca Shear.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Public Radio Network promotes Alaska's cultures, regions, and ethnic diversity, including a commitment to informing and empowering Alaska's Native peoples.
In Canada, scientists are hoping a pile of trash left by early Inuit settlers north of Inuvik will be full of archaeological treasures. A researcher will be studying the table scraps left at an Inuit village almost 800 years ago. The bones were found in 1989 at the Tiktaalik site, about 200 kilometers northeast of Inuvik. As the CBC's Chris Harbord reports, it's hoped they hold some secrets about the early Inuit migration from Alaska.
Waterloo, Ontario graduate student John Moody is expecting an unusual package. Soon he'll take delivery of about 9,000 seal bones from the Northwest Territories.
I think it does surprise people. In archaeology, we're really looking at people's garbage.
They're leftovers from meals enjoyed by the Thule Inuit almost 800 years ago. It's thought the Thule migrated into the Canadian Arctic from what is now Alaska. But scientists like Moody don't know why they came.
I'm kind of interested in the reasons for the Thule migration, if it had anything to do with what they're eating or if what they're eating reflected the reasons why they're moving.
Moody says marks in the bones will shed light on butchering practices and which animal species were around at the time. The Canadian Museum of Civilization is excited about Moody's archaeological dumpster dive. They've given him a $5,000 research award. David Morrison is the museum's director of archaeology. He's also one of the scientists who first dug up the Inuit site.
It's very historically focused. A scholarly attempt to figure out what life was like in the past and what people were doing.
Morrison says it's become hard to find money for this kind of archaeological research in the Arctic. Scientists have better luck getting funding for projects about climate change. Moody will spend the next year picking through the old bones. Chris Harbord, Inuvik.
Plans by managers of the Alaska State Fair to sell verdant farm acreage to an industrial skills training school created a fracas in Palmer last month. The offer by Northern Industrial Training to build a $24 million vocational school bordering the fairgrounds is expected to create economic opportunities for the area, but as APRN's Ellen Lockyer reports, the deal is encountering substantial obstacles.
News that managers of the Alaska State Fair had planned to sell 40 acres of prime farmland to Northern Industrial Training for a vocational school erupted in mid-March, dousing irate Palmer farmers with an ashfall of indignation intense enough to spur them into action to block the plan. The fair's board of directors listened to the farmers' objections and came up with an alternative, an offer of a substitute parcel of land to NIT for development. Negotiations over that deal are continuing, and concerns over the fair's involvement with NIT have subsided somewhat, but many questions still have to be answered as fair managers, farmland preservation advocates, and NIT wrestle with the compromise. Dean Phipps, marketing director for the fair, says a 30-acre alternative site is now under consideration for purchase by NIT. Phipps says a long-standing partnership with NIT has been beneficial to the fair.
I think that sets up a scenario for us to see the benefits of the expansion of their program. Their plans include developing all sorts of trades training.
At present, NIT uses fair property as a site for truck driver training under an agreement with the fair forged 3 years ago. The new NIT plan expands the company's training programs into the construction trades. According to Phipps, the fair is like a small, growing city and has many of the same infrastructure problems. Phipps says NIT staff and trainees can help the fair meet the challenge of keeping its older buildings in good shape. He says the fair is looking ahead to NIT's expansion as a plus.
Last year on second Saturday, we had as many as probably 45,000 or more people here. And that puts tremendous demands on everything from service roads to our sewage system. The thought of them expanding their program to include electrical, plumbing, other trades, to where we could get additional help on some of the projects, just a good way for us to go.
As part of the land compromise, the 40 acres of prime farmland the fair originally planned to sell to NIT is to be put into a federally funded program that keeps agricultural land in production. The Alaska Farmland Trust pays owners of ag land the development rights to the property and locks the land into future sale to agricultural interests only. And that's something fair board member Bruce Bush applauds.
As a farmer, I don't want to see any farmland disturbed. And as a board member, I think it's a great solution because NIT wins and a fair wins and everybody wins.
Paperwork on the trust agreement has to meet a mid-May deadline. The fair's board of directors is in favor of continuing negotiations with NIT regarding the smaller plot, but the bulk of the redesign of the plan now falls on NIT's plate. NIT's plan includes shops, dormitory facilities for 80 students, classrooms, offices, and a cafeteria. And all of that has to be scaled down to a smaller footprint. Joey Crum is executive vice president of NIT. He took a break from teaching classes to discuss what's next for the training company.
As of right now, I can't tell you exactly what or if any will be cut out, but there was a green belt built into the first facility that would encompass the boundary lines of the property. And the property that we may be looking at now already has a green belt in place. So there is a possibility that nothing could be sacrificed.
Crum says it's NIT's ambition to build a self-sustaining campus at the fairgrounds. He was not specific as to where the money will come from to allow the company to begin construction.
Well, it's coming, you know, from various organizations and grants, and, you know, we're shouldering part of the burden, but it's going to be done in phases. So the phases of the construction will reflect the level of funding and at what point it comes, you know, if it comes this year or next year or 2 years down the road.
The land switch is further complicated because the alternative site lies within City of Palmer boundaries, which could create permitting and zoning hurdles not required by the original parcel. Crum says NIT is talking with the city now and does not expect any blocks to the plan. John Harkey, president of the fair's board of directors, is keeping a positive outlook.
Currently, there's no written agreement for the land sale. You know, the contract's currently being prepared for review. The fair has begun negotiations with the Farmland Trust to sell the developmental rights to the 40-acre parcel. Well, we're a nonprofit corporation, but we certainly listen and do our best to find solutions for the public.
But Harkey says the fair's board has been in discussions with NIT for close to 8 months. And if NIT gets discouraged and finds another plot of land to buy, and if the Alaska Farmland Trust is not successful in raising the $1 million to pay the fair for the development rights to the original parcel of land, the fair could lose twice. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Rosemary Alexander, Ed Schoenfeld, and Rebecca Sheeran Juno, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and the CBC's Chris Harbord in Inuvik. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juno, and Steve Heimel and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Comfort Suites Anchorage International Airport. Comfort Suites, an all-suites hotel, is now open with a 24-hour shuttle service, indoor pool, and high-speed internet access. Reservations at 243-8080.
From resource issues to recreational activities, APRN brings you the up-to-date information you need for life in Alaska. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.